Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. Today we have a fun, especially fun guest for me, because we are talking to former mayor of Fresno, current Central Valley Community Foundation chief executive officer, former cheer camp attender. What other titles do we want to give you? Co-host of the Evangelical-ish podcast.
Former head cheerleader of Fresno State Bulldogs.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
We're going to laugh a lot today.
Welcome. How do you be successful as the head cheerleader?
Let's get to that.
We didn't even say her name yet.
Yeah.
And we have Ashley Swearingen with us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey. I promise to be on good behavior. I don't want to get Danielle or Jordan in any trouble today.
Mm. I have a feeling I'm a giggly person.
Yeah.
Like
Oh my god.
I laugh a lot.
I can feel it already in the room. We're just going to go there, and that's okay. That's okay.
Let's just say Danielle and I have a long and storied history around the many topics of Fresno and its land.
Yes.
And therefore, we're going to try to keep it in the lane today and not be too unprofessional.
We'll do our best to do that. But we're so excited to have you on this Ask Me Anything AMA episode. And we asked our audience on Instagram to send in lots of questions, and they did. But I'm going to preempt our audience because there was a big thing that happened yesterday. So we're recording the podcast Friday. Big thing happened yesterday, Thursday, which is that the Governor Gavin Newsom came to Fresno, and you were there with him.
And he was just here to talk about gas taxes, right? That's why he was here exclusively for that.
Not at all talk about gas taxes and to not at all talk about Trump politics and his blue state. But in fact, that is what we talked about.
Mm.
Yeah. So why were you excited to have a Gavin in town? Let's get the news out of the way and then we'll talk about the fun part.
Okay. Why was I excited? We had the chance to roll out our four-county 20-year inclusive economic development plan to the governor, which is the product of literally, gosh, we counted up 3,000 volunteer hours by 300 community members, civic organizations, this huge effort of the last couple of years. The state asked us and like the entire state, 13 economic regions, hey, what's it going to take? You know, where do you see yourself in 10 years? What are the kind of investments that are needed for inclusive, sustainable economic development? We take those questions very seriously in our region. LA can afford to be like, eh, who's asking? We don't get out of bed for anything short of like billions of dollars from the federal government. But we in the Valley, we're like, and in the mountain region of Central California, if you ask us, what do you need? We are all in. And we were rolling out that plan to the governor yesterday, and it was the first of 13 economic regions reporting in after this two-year planning exercise. It was a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I know a lot of work went into it.
Yeah.
Also, the cynical part of me is this a soft launch? Actually, I didn't say this. Rob and our team said this. Is this Gavin's soft launch for president?
Okay. I think...
And can we claim that it happened in Fresno?
Sure, because it was his first public appearance since the November 5th election. I don't know. I think it probably started like November 6th.
But, yeah, that's true.
But I don't know. It came up. We had a roundtable with the governor and somebody gestured out, hey, governor, we really are wanting your support over the next 2 years. And then someone cutely said, and beyond. And the governor made a big joke about, I'm unemployed in 2 years, so I'll be looking for work. I'll see you guys down. Anyway, but he knew what everyone was talking about. And I don't know. It clearly, the machine that is his brand, they have no choice but to keep pushing again on November 6th. That is exactly what they needed to do. So who knows what's going to happen, but I think clearly he's pursuing that.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
Do you feel like, I have so many politics questions in this cycle, but maybe starting with, are you surprised that Fresno County went to Trump?
No, not given what happened nationwide. Mm-hmm. And not, I think, I don't know if you saw the New York Times story that came out yesterday morning. I'll repeat the observation I had at Palm and Herndon. It'll be more to your audience than people in New York reading about the Trump Brigade down Herndon Avenue. But it was the Sunday before the election. And I'm thinking, most people have voted by me. We know California's going to go blue. I don't know. I just didn't see a lot of animation consistently in our county and for understandable reasons. And I'm sitting on the corner of Palm and Herndon trying to go north on Palm to get to my Sunday afternoon yoga class, which I absolutely love. And I'm telling you, the entire green light cycle, which we all know, those lights are synchronized.
Thank you, Scott Mosier.
And Patrick Weidmiller. And so it's car. And it's minutes. goes on and on and on. I'm telling you, probably 40 or 50 vehicles with Trump flags and don't tread on me and all the stuff, like minivans and moms and little kids like waving out the window. So I thought to myself, my goodness, like there are some animated and motivated people who are here casting their votes for Trump, knowing that it's not going to affect the outcome of the national election. But mm-hmm. boy, they still felt strongly about it. So, you know, that was maybe a little anecdote of, yeah, Fresno County was going to go Trump.
Are you surprised? We just ran the numbers this week and dug into the archives, and the turnout in this election, we haven't certified it yet, but it's about 62%, which is the lowest in over 50 years.
Wow. I had not heard that.
Yeah, we just reported that this week. And I think the last time we had this low of turnout was in 1972.
Whoa, the year of my birth.
Really? Yes. Yeah. So I think that's like a big part of the story here locally is I think over 40,000 less Democrats showed up in 24 than they did in 2020.
And I didn't know that about Fresno County, yeah. But that's certainly what we're hearing across the nation. So right. It's interesting that it's true here as well. Mm-hmm. And I wonder about the rest of the state.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the New York Times has a nice graphic where they looked at turnout and where it was depressed. And there was a lot of California counties that had just really dampened Democratic turnout in particular. Hmm. So anyways, but you have historically been a Republican. Do you still identify as a Republican?
I no longer identify as a Republican.
Why?
Do you want to hear the story?
Yeah.
Like the whole, it's
yeah.
a very
Tell
dramatic,
us why.
It's
yeah,
a dramatic it. Moment in my life that absolutely no one gave a damn about, which is totally fine.
Great.
But so I had to go in for my real ID. So this would have been probably about 2018, 2019. So before the pandemic, but certainly in Trump won. And for me, I was starting to be very uncomfortable, even during the Obama administration, as a person with an evangelical Christian background. I was starting to be very uncomfortable with the way that center-right, started with Tea Party stuff, then it rolled into Trump stuff, was really wrapping the political ideology in the Jesus and Christian flag. Like, quite literally, we saw that on January 6, 2020. And so both my husband and I are just like, man, like, I feel you can, I think in America, like you shouldn't be voting a religion. I think Jesus could be on either side of this aisle. I just think it's really a problem when we so deeply integrate Christianity or any faith with, and therefore it has to be this vote selection. That is a political mindset that I personally feel like we worked really hard when I was at the city to say, hey, look, politics out, community first. And what really pushed against that when I was at the city was this Christian ideology that only associated with a Republican ticket and ballot. So I was already feeling weird about that. And then Trump's in office and all this sort of thing. And for me, that's a very cool, I could still espouse probably things that would sound pretty traditional Republican. But when you start telling me like Jesus is going to say you're a bad Christian if you don't vote a certain way, like, I'm out. I cannot do that.
Let me push you a little bit, because I think it's interesting. I'm seeing, like, are you familiar with this Barstool Republican thing, this phenomenon where it's like quasi-libertarian, somewhat amoral?
Yeah.
Like, I see it moving more in that direction than theocratic Christian national description.
But let me tell you, as a preacher's wife in 2017, from 2008 to 2016, 2017, there is a whole thread that in a whole swath of the political right side of the equation, maybe it's 25% or something like that of the electorate, maybe 30%, 40% of the Republican vote, but that's the world I was in.
Sure.
And I agree with you. There is also like a tech bro, and I can see that too. But for me, cannot do religion requires you to vote a certain way. That is a violation, actually, of my personal faith. That is, no, it's nothing more important than my deeply held spiritual like purpose and faith. So anyway, it's a long way of saying I already was in that mindset. So here I am trying to get my real ID. And I had my PG&E bill, and I had my, you know, tax bill, and I had my whatever, and I'm standing there, and I have my appointment at Blackstone and Herndon, and I love going to the DMV because you just get to see like regular people, regular life, like this is our community. And I particularly love the DMV at Blackstone and Sierra. So I'm standing there and have my appointment. They point me to a kiosk and I'm like putting in my information, blah, blah, blah. And no one's looking. No one gives a damn about anything I'm doing. And then all of a sudden, I didn't realize the question comes up. You're essentially re-registering to vote when you get your real ID. What party are you a part of? And I was just like, oh my God, I'm having a moment. I now know it's one thing to register to vote as a Republican when you're younger and no, and you agree with the party on this, not on that, blah, blah, blah. And at the local level, we're all kind of purpley independent anyway. It's another thing to be standing in the DMV in like 2018, knowing what I knew and experiencing what I experienced. It's another thing to again say, and I still choose this. And I couldn't do it. So I went to Klein to State and I was like, oh, I just did something big. But like I said, nobody cared. And it was a perfect way to make that decision in that moment where no longer a public official.
Yeah.
I turned around and looked to my right and my left and I'm like, I just went to Klein to State like that. And everyone's like, who are you? What are you? Who even cares? Yeah. But anyway, that's the story.
That's a big deal. That's a great story. Yeah. What year was that?
I think it was, I can't remember if it was 18 or 19.
Yeah.
Definitely pre-pandemic. And I was definitely out of office. So somewhere.
Pre-January 6th.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So we have received a lot of questions from online that we want you to answer. Yes. And this one's kind of a broad question. I'm going to make it a little more specific. So the question as we received it was, quote, thoughts on light rail. Are we interpreting that as light rail in Fresno?
Yeah. Should we ever get it?
Yeah. Should we have a light rail?
Did you know that there are plans in the works to study it at the moment?
Maybe there have always been plans in the works.
But there's actually like a study.
It's like a concept of a plan.
Yeah. No,
it's a concept of a plan.
We are moving along.
This is actually more, we've moved beyond the concept of a plan to an actual plan that's going to get funded.
Okay.
Yeah. Look, and can I ask, is that a city thing, a county thing? What's the scope of the thinking about it?
I think it's a COG thing.
Yeah. What do you think about it conceptually in a city that's designed for sprawl?
Yeah. Okay. So here's, I'm only going to repeat what all of these amazing experts that I used to work with at the city of Fresno, including one Danielle Bergstrom, would tell me about things like this. I don't know, but what all of the land use and transportation people and the experts tend to say is that it's usually like never worth the expenditure per mile in terms of the value of the revitalization, that the reason why most people think, oh, great idea, let's do a light rail. This was when we were at the city, Danielle, you'll remember the idea was, never mind Fulton Mall, let's just put light rail between downtown and the tower and everything will be fine. And Danielle's shaking her head no. So most of what I've learned and heard is like it like almost never produces the kind of outcomes you're looking for, and particularly for the cost. Having said that, I am always a fan, and particularly in Fresno, where we love to pretend like nothing applies to us here. No smart people from outside of this area could ever come and give us information about how other cities and other regions have done things. If there's a qualified and capable team of experts who are coming to yet again assess this for us, great, let's see what it says. I think probably the biggest thing to keep in mind is there is no such thing as a silver bullet as it relates to revitalizing disinvested parts of our communities. We actually just have to stop the disinvestment and we have to stop the underlying practices that have led to those conditions that are now 50, 60, 70 years old. Like, we got to do the hard stuff. And in some ways, I feel like as expensive and difficult as light rail would be, it's actually easier than doing the real hard stuff.
Now, I wonder about outcomes. I don't know if you saw this, but there was an op-ed in the Washington Post a couple days ago that looked at like the outcome of protected bike lanes in DC.
Yeah.
And they found, and it found that actually bike usage went down.
Interesting.
And so they said the biggest effect was on surge times or like traffic-y times during rush hour. And it dissuaded people from driving, but that was not the outcome that they intended when they created.
Wait, I don't get it. So
there was less bicycles and there was also less cars.
Why would there be less bicycles?
I don't know.
They don't know.
Yeah. There's too many variables, right?
Yeah.
We can't really predict why something caused something, but it didn't cause
the intended effect, right? Is it maybe the thinking that taking the lane away from the cars and giving it instead to the cyclists created more traffic, and therefore the cars avoid that area during peak
time? It's possible, but the outcome is that less people are driving. Well, maybe they're taking more public transit. So sometimes do something, right?
Right,
and
yeah.
And it has unintended consequences.
And the thing with light rail, the thing it's supposed to solve for is public transit times. We have bus rapid transit, but we don't have dedicated right-of-way for the buses. They
right.
still have to, they get a little bit of signal prioritization at the traffic lights, but
it still takes too long.
It takes way too long. And then there's a real estate impact too, where light rail inherently boosts property values around land adjacent to the stations. And so the theory is that can help incentivize developers to develop in places that they would not necessarily have developed
otherwise.
Is that otherwise.
True? Because I actually thought that was always the hope, but it didn't necessarily deliver.
It really
outcomes.
Depends on the city. That's played out pretty decently in the Twin Cities and Portland, I believe in Seattle as well. To a less, but it's very variable, right? That happening in certain parts of the Bay Area around certain types of transit stations. But BART has not been a silver bullet for every place that has a station.
And it's such a great point, because in the Bay Area where the density is greater,
right.
You can, and land is at such a premium,
right.
You could absolutely see why dedicated public transportation infrastructure like that would add value. But would that be true here? Would people just screw it, let's go keep running out to
it's an issue, right? Because back to what you said earlier,
there aren't constraints.
The more that it is easier and cheaper to build single family subdivisions,
that's where it's gonna go. Water flows downhill.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear the story of me trying to ride a bike in a protected bike lane in
please
DC?
Do.
Okay. So I haven't ridden a bike in probably 40 years, I'm gonna guess. And so I'm in DC, this is sometime maybe a year and a half ago. And of course, Sarah Moffitt is with me and she wants to rent everything. Like we're either scooting or biking somewhere. And she's like, come on, let's go.
Like one of those city bikes?
Yeah. And so we get on the bike, I get on a bike, she gets on a bike too. And off she goes, all of this, whatever. So I'm like, okay, this is fun. These electronic bikes are quite heavy, by the way. So if you haven't ridden a bike in a while, and then you're like trying to ride on congested sidewalks and like going around the memorials and all this kind of stuff. I was a little intimidated. So part one of this story is in a protected bike lane, there are still fast moving things that you can run into. There are other bikers. There are scooter people. There are things. And I almost ran into and had a full on collision with another cyclist. We pull off and we're going around the World War II Memorial and I lose control of the bike and I actually run into the World War II Memorial. Anyway, all is to say, it's hard to ride a bike. A, in DC, B, C, there's other traffic in the protected bike lane.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Like the scooters.
They'll take you out. Yeah,
all
that's
right.
True.
We're going to keep this moving along. This is an interesting question. What is the strangest complaint you received while in office?
Okay, the strangest complaint. Okay, you want to know a really funny story?
Always.
Oh my God, I think it might be the city lights complaint.
I'm trying to remember this.
I can't believe you did not immediately know what I'm talking about, Danielle.
I'm sure.
I'm ignorant, so tell me the story.
Lord help us all. This was probably one of the funniest moments of my entire life. To this day. Okay, this was back, some of you may recall a little thing called the Great Recession. Yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Old enough to remember.
You're old enough to remember the Great Recession and the Great Drought. We're budget cutting. It's every quarter. We're putting out a new budget. Times are tough. We do all of the easy things, whatever. We're getting down to the bottom of the barrel. How can we possibly save the city money and all that? Try to avoid layoffs, blah, blah, blah. So we got to the point where the Public Works Department said, we have a lot of stubbed out subdivisions that are not built out yet. We don't have the LMD, the districts turned on yet. We're paying, somehow the general fund was paying for the light bills for these stubbed out neighborhoods with no houses. And we proposed to cut the street lights in those places. On the surface, it sounds like a terrifying thing because everyone's thinking their streetlights are being cut. But it was like, no, we're cutting where there aren't people living yet, but it was like $400,000 or $500,000 of savings, as I can recall. So not a big deal. But at that point, like we're trying to find as many savings as we can. So I can't recall if we got it through the city council or not, but it made a lot of headlines. It made a lot of editorial pages. There's a famous cartoon of me like cutting off the tree branch, sitting on the wrong side and something about streetlight, whatever. It was a whole big thing. And so we're getting through it and whatever. At the time, Councilmember Brand, before he was the mayor, was getting, he was always like very paying a lot of attention to what the administration was doing and very quick to be like, oh, that's exactly wrong or that's exactly right. Like he was just very like on his toes about this stuff. So we get this long email that he forwards from a constituent, and the constituent says, hey, I called, my street light is out. And I looked at the number on the streetlight, and I called the city lights department, and I told them that my streetlight was out, and this customer service was terrible. This person didn't care that my streetlight was out. They told me that they didn't give a rat's ass about my street. I cannot believe this city government is the worst I've ever seen. So Mayor Brown, Councilmember Brown, was very quick to forward it to me and be like, your government is a mess. What are you thinking? You need to fix the customer service department at the city lights department. So I scroll down, and we look to see the constituent had provided the number that this person had called to complain about her city lights. And sure enough, this constituent had looked up in the phone book city lights and accidentally called the strip joint city lights over by the airport.
They have bad customer service?
And had a lengthy conversation about the light poles and how they were not turning on properly. And
that can be interpreted a number of ways.
And the poor person who answered this call was like, I don't give a shit like about the city light poles. And then Lee was just like, so we told him anyway, he thought it was hilarious. And
he should have gone over to City Lights and cleaned up shop.
He could, you know what? No stone left unturned. But that was definitely probably a highlight of my time in office, was just watching that exchange play out and imagining Lee being so upset and like this person talking to the stripper bouncer about their street light being out.
I love that. Here's another question that's not a question, but I think it ties back to the light rail discussion, and I'm gonna maybe add my own spin on it. They say thoughts on building upwards and more densely throughout Fresno and not just downtown. And I would maybe add to that, under your administration, and I worked on some of this when I worked for you, there was a lot of work to try to relax zoning codes, create a general plan that would make dense building a lot more easy. And
right,
we have not necessarily seen as much of that as we would like. So what's your take, your hot take in 2024 about why that's so hard?
Generally, before talking about why it's so hard, but like the vision of, can you have density someplace other than downtown? I think mm-hmm. the answer broadly is yes.
Mm-hmm.
But let's all remember the general plan, was it the 2025 general plan that we mm-hmm. updated to 2035, which was adopted in like 2024?
No, the one before
Mayor
that.
Autry general, yeah.
That was like 2006, maybe.
Okay. So that general plan called for densities at equal proportions of downtown in Woodward Park. We've seen some commercial density, commercial buildings up there, commercial office. And that, like Nick Iovino, who was the planning director at the time, was like, yeah, we can have two ends of the barbell. Essentially what they were setting up was two downtowns. Not great, but whatever. There was some stuff going on and we just let it be because it's already built. But the idea that you could connect downtown to transit corridor, now that's the vision of the 2035 general plan. And those transit corridors have now been, you know, upzoned. Is that the right word? Upzoned mm-hmm. on Blackstone and not quite yet. I don't, higher density on some key corridors. I don't think quite yet California. We didn't end up on California Avenue, mm-hmm. but it was like envisioned Shaw mm-hmm. Avenue. So for sure, the spine of the city, which is Blackstone, that's what that whole mixed-use rezoning was for and about. What I think it was like really clever and fantastic, and I do hope to live to see the day where this conversion happens. There was like neighborhood scale density mm-hmm. and like slightly higher, and then we have these activity centers that are much, much higher density, like Blackstone and Shaw and like other key activity corridors like around City College and blah, blah, blah. So I think that's such a cool vision for where we could see the footprint go. And gosh, we zoned for 75,000 units in downtown. If you consider the zoning along Blackstone, there's another 10,000 housing units, I think, that we zoned for. Like everyone freaks out when you start talking about this because they assume you're saying we're bringing this right to your existing single family neighborhood.
Right, no.
We got so much zoning like tucked into nooks and crannies where there was room for it and where it made sense to invest in higher levels of transit, that kind of stuff. I think it was actually really great. So why hasn't it happened? For one thing, the pandemic was nobody's friend, literally, and for sure not in the built environment world. One, two, there are real challenges to convert. Like our market conditions really only support one form of development around here, and that is converting cheap, flat ag land on the periphery of incorporated cities to low-density single-family housing. Anything other than that, besides luxury multifamily apartments in wealthy neighborhoods, everything else requires a subsidy. Period. It just does. My question is not, I guess now we can all be like, oh, hindsight's 2020. We saw this coming. Mm. We would see it with projects we were trying to get finance in downtown, and it's still true today. Market's upside down. The costs are what they are. The rents are too low. So you can't get this stuff financed without some kind of overall strategic financing mechanism. I think there's got to be a play that creates like a financing district of some sort, an infrastructure financing district along the transit corridors. Measure C could be a potential source of funding for this, but we are going to have to invest in the public infrastructure that's needed at the whole district level to help write down the cost of development in, let's say, on a Blackstone
corridor. Do you think people actually want it, though?
We don't need everybody. Like the number, if you consider the number of housing units in the Fresno metro area, gosh, it's probably 300,000-400,000 housing units. So like having some thousands in downtown and along Blackstone, what we know from what's been built in downtown, everything's rented. Rents have gone up. There's a wait list. So I think if it's done right and well, and I think if it's nestled in with the, like, again, community, you don't think there'd be some really cool things that could be built around Radcliffe Stadium, open up that thing for public use, make it beautiful with Measure P dollars, housing tucked in around the community college campus? Absolutely, I think those things. We are in a, like, starvation desert of housing units. So yeah, I think people would rent them for sure.
And if you, a couple of data points on that. So the city did a study, was it last year or 2 years ago, that looked at market demand for different housing types. And what they found was, maybe unsurprisingly, the single family residential market has been overbuilt in Fresno by quite a bit. And so we have a huge proportion of single family homes in Fresno that are rented, way more than what in any other city, because that's what we build. And so instead of people who are young, single professionals that are looking for a place to live, they have a really hard time getting into apartments because there's just not enough. And what they have is single family homes, and a 25-year-old doesn't always want to live by themselves in a two or three bedroom house with a huge yard to take care of.
Right. And not to mention the opportunity for condos and townhomes, like ownership opportunities on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
I think we said this a lot, Danielle and I did and others when we were at the city, but it's like Fresno is a ketchup store. And you walk into this ketchup store, and everywhere the eye can see, there are like bottles of ketchup. There's Heinz, there's this, there's that, and there's blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's all ketchup. And then someone goes, yeah, do you have any mango salsa? And they're like, no, man, we just sell ketchup here. And so then the mango salsa customer walks out the door, and the owner of the ketchup store says, see, people only want ketchup. Like, it's all we know. Mm-hmm. It's all we know. And then people who build in our community, there certainly are luxury apartment builders. They make a good living, and they can produce their family businesses. They can produce a certain amount every year. We don't have like corporate and institutional level of investment in multifamily in this market. We just don't. Our market's too small. It's what we've heard from a lot of larger scale builders. So like those guys are fine. They're doing fine. They're from their own perspective.
Right. And if the market is unfavorable to them in Fresno, they go to Clovis or they go to a Madera County.
Yeah. And they're just on their own pace building, and they're gonna move at their own pace.
Yeah.
And then again, it's hard. This is in my view, it's why the community and the city and local governments have to work together to bridge gaps of all sorts in building in these harder to build places. It takes the community coming together to figure it out. And by the way, we sure did it really well when it comes to community public investment in the periphery. We've subsidized the heck out of that stuff.
Yeah.
Does it stand to reason that we'll have to do the same thing for neighborhoods that have been left behind and neighborhoods where there are places to build, but it's harder to build? Yeah, we're going to have to come together and figure out solutions for that.
All right. Another fun question. What's the oddest?
You don't want to keep debating about this fun
topic. No, my job is to keep us moving at a steady pace. We can have all our wonky sidebars we want, but we do have to keep it. Think about listeners.
Okay.
You're being far more serious, by the way, than
I know.
I
this is a very
expected.
Serious conversation.
Yeah, I'm about to make it unserious. If Fresno were a food, what would it be and why?
You know, this is actually a very serious and poetic response to that.
Oh, God.
But did you? Okay. I know. Apologies. But I'll bet if you Google James Tyner.
Okay.
Fresno Poet Laureate.
Oh, yeah.
I know James. Mm-hmm. Wonderful guy.
There is a poem that he wrote about Fresno's like food scene and like how it reflects our community. And I, the reason why I can't just like name one food, I don't know, like a Cheeto or a taco or something, is because he said it so perfectly. It's like Fresno is, you know, grilling hot dogs and rolling it up in a tortilla. It is sopping up your corn tortilla in a bowl of pho. It is that there's so many foods that come together.
It's a fusion food.
It's a fusion experience. Mm. But anyway, yes, for the listeners, James Tyner, what was the name of that poem? I have it hanging on my wall.
He was
Fresno's first poet laureate. And I love that the poem he wrote about was about food.
Absolutely. All right. You want to go to now a serious question?
Yeah, I'll go to another one. I like this question a lot. What do you think, as being a mayor for two terms, is the most effective advocacy method for community members who want to be more effective in their advocacy?
How do you stoke the fire?
Yeah.
For just to get more people involved in their own community?
Yeah. What's the most effective form of public participation?
How should they pressure local officials?
Yeah.
What's effective?
How to pressure? Oh, easy. Volume of people, period. That is 100% what it is.
Is it emails? Is it showing up at city council?
Both. Mm-hmm. We used to say, like, you could change the entire direction of the city if 20 people would come to a council meeting and say something. It's shocking. It is shocking how insulated and isolated decision-making can be in a city like Fresno, and especially post-COVID, when everyone got used to, like, just staying away and doing things on Zoom and that kind of thing. But I'm telling you, probably one of the most exhilarating things that we did when I was at the city was the Fulton Mall vote and building a coalition of people who otherwise didn't think about downtown, didn't come downtown. They were, why should I care? I live 8-9 miles away. I never go there anyway. And we spent a year doing a campaign called I Believe in Downtown Fresno. And we had a great video that talked about the history of Fulton Mall and the importance of downtown. We showed it to 1,000 people outside of the usual downtown City Hall bubble. And we built an army of people who cared and who showed up, all wearing orange T-shirts and all there for the vote. And I'm telling you, it was the most compelling thing I've ever seen. The chambers were full, the balcony on the ground floor. And it was a really fun. We had the vote at night. It was a really fun night. And we got the vote through.
Okay.
Ooh.
Next one. This one's strange, but maybe not as strange as it used to be. If aliens landed in Fresno, where would you take them first?
Would I take them?
Yeah. If you were their concierge for Fresno, where would you take them?
Well, obviously they're already here.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, they made it.
Aren't they like walking around at night called like the Fresno night crawlers?
Yeah. I spend a lot of time on Twitter watching videos on this.
Seriously? So
where would you take
them? I love that, by the way. Have you not seen the night crawler?
I know about the night crawler.
I'm more interested in UAPs, but I hear what you're saying.
Okay. Also, that probably would pull up some interesting things if you do like Fresno night walkers.
Did you see that like thing?
Is it night crawlers or night walkers?
Night crawlers.
Okay, don't Google night walkers.
Yeah, but did you see that thing? It was over, the video came out a few years ago. It looked like a jellyfish in the sky above Fresno. Did you see that?
I don't think I did.
Okay, so what would you do with the aliens? Where would you take them?
It depends on. I'd probably take him to see the Renoir at Strait of Mariposa. Would you not? And then would you not go to the Chicken Shack?
I don't know if I would go to the Chicken Shack. Where would you take him, Dottie?
I'm sorry. That's such a random and specific thing to say. Oh, God. I don't know. I'd take him to Adrian's. I just went to Adrian's today. It's my new obsession.
Okay. Mm. Okay, that's legit.
The tortillas.
Yeah. No, we'd go see the butt crack at the washerwoman. And then we'd go at Chicken Shack.
Oh, my God. Sure. I feel like that's been part of your bit for a long time. Like,
that's why I'm saying it. Do you know how many famous people I've taken to see the washerwoman? So why would I not also take the
I know. Alien? Who's the most famous people?
That's a good question.
And do you literally say butt crack when
I know. I only said that just now.
Okay.
But it's funny because we were walking down Fulton Street yesterday and the governor just left and our team was really excited. So we're like, let's go to Los Panchos and have some, of course, we're going to have some chips and guac and a spicy margarita to celebrate do our victory lap. And we're walking past the washerwoman, and one of the people on my team goes, that's not a very flattering way to bend over and have a sculpture made of you. So that's why it's top of mind for me, the butt crack. But normally, I always talk about it's the only Renoir. This particular casting, there are 5 in the world, the only one that's not behind glass. You can actually walk up and run your fingers across the Renoir name. It's a pretty big deal. I think the most famous, okay, so the HUD secretary, Sean Donovan,
yeah,
that was a big
deal.
Cool. He went on to be the OMB director for President Obama. I have like government famous. I wouldn't say like famous. Not Hollywood. More
yeah,
like government.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. You probably met Taylor Swift.
Yeah, but I just went backstage. I did not get her downtown.
I know, that's too bad.
Yeah, I did meet Taylor Swift.
Didn't take her to the butt crack.
Did not take her to the butt crack. Which, okay. By the way, back then, I'm telling you, she was probably a size zero.
I believe it.
She was so thin, and she had her dresses on display at the concert, and it was literally the width of, like, my knee. She's tiny.
Didn't you give her the key to the city?
I didn't give her the key to the city. This is an embarrassing, hopefully... Does Taylor listen to your podcast?
If she did, I would lose my absolute mind.
We assume so.
Danielle, does everybody know what a Swiftie you are?
And that's only recent. Oh, yeah, I am a massive Swiftie, so I would die.
The funny story there is Taylor Swift came to the Save Mart Center. There were only two perks being the mayor of Fresno. One was you could kind of park wherever you wanted. Two was that if a great concert came to the Save Mart Center, because SMG was the contractor for downtown properties, you could call the SMG people and be like, hey, I need a pass to this show. So we went in my time in office. I went to see the Wiggles, and I went to see Taylor Swift, and I went to see Paul McCartney. So in 8 years, I had three outings
and
there.
And the Wiggles was one of them.
Because I had young kids.
Oh,
and
okay.
So we got to take Sydney and Sam, and we sat in the president's skybox, because I actually called John Welty and I said, are you going to use those Wiggles tickets? And he said no. And so then we went. Anyway, so we go to see Taylor Swift. I have my daughter with me at the time, who's probably about 9. She has a girlfriend with her from fourth grade. And we get to go behind stage. The day of this show, I'm like, oh my God, let's declare it Taylor Swift Day, just to demystify the what happens when a day is named after you in the city of Fresno. It's something like this. An elected official goes out to their assistant and they say, hey, can you draft up on blue paper, like, there, like, whereas, therefore, be it declared, this is Taylor Swift Day. Cheryl Burns, my assistant, types it up. She, like, Googles stuff about Taylor Swift. We put it in there and, like, we print it out. And on blue paper, blue little marbly paper, and then we put the little red, white, and blue sticker at the bottom with the gold seal, and we put it in a navy blue Mayor Swearingen folder with the city seal on the front, and I've signed it, and therefore it's now Taylor Swift Day. And people don't realize it's the day and the year. So it's like, it's only like one 24-hour period that's your day. It's not every day in future years. It's only that one day. Anyway, so we get to meet her behind scenes. I hand her the proclamation, and Taylor Swift says to me, oh my goodness, you made it Taylor Swift Day in the city of Fresno? She says, I've never had a city name a day after me before. I'm so honored that you would bestow this on me. And she says, can you tell me, like, what goes into declaring a day after someone?
She would ask that, but yeah.
And so I said, I'm literally in my mind, I'm like, I went outside and told Cheryl to hit print on a thing and change the paper, make it the blue paper. And I signed it and I put it in a blue folder. But in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, this is a big deal for her. So I have to dress it up. So I said, it's part of my duties. It's one of the authorities I have on behalf of the people of Fresno. I have this duty bestowed upon me. And she's, oh, yes, the duties. And then she tweets about it after the show.
Stop.
Yeah, you could go back and find the tweet probably.
Oh, I will definitely look. Because yeah. I remember when this happened and being like, oh, Taylor Swift, I don't really care about her.
And now you're like,
and now I'm like, I could have met Taylor.
No, and we had our picture taken with her. So Sydney and her friend and me and Taylor Swift, I have that picture.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say you're sitting down with a newly elected mayor and you're taking him or her under your wing and giving a little guidance. Maybe they're really idealistic. They think they're going to make a lot of change really quickly. What advice would you give them? How would you encourage them to think about the role, both in its challenges and your tactics and strategies for making it effective?
What a good question. Okay, so the first thing I would love to inspire any elected official within the sound of that he actually listens to this. So exactly maybe 5, 6, I don't know, 0? Who knows who's going to listen to this? But any current or former or future elected official who may hear, this is what I would first want to instill. Number one, it's a lot of work to get yourself into the role, but it's not enough to be in charge. Like, just getting the job is not the point. It is only a waypoint to where you're really trying to go. And that is, you have to use that office effectively every day. You have to Yeah, it's not enough to be in charge. Things actually have to change in our community. Now, you could live in another place that's really great, where everything's fine. And then it's just, like, no, be a good steward of what you've got. You don't have to change things. In our region, things have to change. So you have to, I see a lot of elected officials throughout the valley that trying hard, intended, but sometimes it's just about occupying the seat. And I would just say, man, let's go a little deeper. And then with that, I actually think you can get a lot of things done. With the strong mayor government, form of government in Fresno really is the envy of a lot of cities around California. And it is a super important role. And you get to hire, appoint staff. You obviously are working closely with the city councils, the policymaking body, but you set the agenda for the city on behalf of the people of Fresno. So you should expect to get a lot done in 8 years.
What obstacle could you not see outside of the job, but you immediately saw once you were in it?
What I didn't understand or expect, and more experienced people than I would know and probably were like, yeah, why didn't you know that going in? But I don't think I realized how much bandwidth has to go to just the routine management functions of running the Municipal Services Corporation. And I used to always tell myself and others on my team and my colleagues at the city council, you have to think about your work in two buckets. There's the management side of your work and there's the leadership side. The management side is very cumbersome because there are things that need to be reformed. There are issues that need to be replumbed or plumbed in the first case. There's a lot that goes into just making the bureaucracy work better, but essentially just to keep service levels the same.
How would you divide those ratio-wise?
I would say a good day for me, if I had a day where it was like 80-20 management leadership, that was a good day. If I had a month where it was like over all in, it was like, actually, I had a 20 or 30% month. We were traveling, so we had a whole week of advocacy. Like, those kinds of things would maybe jack up the number just a bit. But also remember, I was mayor during the Great Recession. And so the management burden of, like, literally every day getting bad news that you gotta cut more, that was a huge management lift. So my first 5 years, we were
basically, it was a wartime administration.
It was
a war with the economy.
Yeah. We were basically, like, bankrupt and didn't declare. But in the middle of that, what was so fun, because everyone was focused on like just trying to manage and of course make the seatbelt click, tighten the belt, whatever. We also, with some grant dollars, we were able to put all this community-driven planning stuff in place, and we didn't have the pressure of the development counter blowing up with the regular single-family home stuff. So we were busily getting input from thousands and thousands and thousands of people and had three or four community-driven planning commissions going at any one time. So then when all that work came to fruition and we were coming out of the recession, we had major policy proposals to put in front of the city council and the people of Fresno. And then from like 2014, 15, 16, we were just like, boom, like knocking it down. And that's because, and I remember reading a book, by the way, called Grassroots Leaders for a New Economy. And it was a study of cities that made a comeback, that went through a trough of some sort and made a comeback. And in some cases, there were cities that didn't have a high. Like Austin emerged all of a sudden, right? But other cases, like cities that had a high, hit some kind of major setbacks and then made a comeback. And what was common across these cities was that during the downturn, city officials were hard at work rebuilding, retooling, and reimagining what was going to happen with the next wave. And so I felt like for the first time, the Great Recession was Fresno's trough, that we went heads down when the budget dropped and we were able to get a lot done. And then when the wave came back, we were able to take advantage of it.
What's your biggest regret as mayor? Or what would you have done differently?
So I think my biggest regret is I went into all the work we did understanding that there's a lot more to the equation than what I thought. Like, I'm overall pretty pleased with what we were able to move. But I really thought it was going to be enough to bring forward a resurgence, particularly in the inner city. And it's, gosh darn it, we really went hard on the levers that city government has to offer, those big challenges. And I thought it was going to be enough. It's it's not enough. It's that and so many other things. And so I think I probably would have had some more humility in the middle of those big things, because I really thought we were like, oh yeah, we're going to be done because everything's going to be so great. And I, that's not the case.
There's what's your biggest unfinished business that you feel like you carry with you?
Figuring out the funding mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like we changed the policies, we changed the regulations, and things still aren't financeable. Mm-hmm. And working with the city on the $250 million of downtown infrastructure, that was like, okay, this is a district scale kind of financial tool. It's one-time money. Is it going to be enough to create different conditions on the ground? I don't know, but I think funding mechanisms are still needed to figure out investment in along transit corridors in inner city Fresno.
Okay. Which piece of city infrastructure are you secretly proudest of, even if no one else appreciates it?
Obviously, the carpet in the convention center.
Okay. What's the carpet?
Is it as cool as the PDX?
I've walked on it, but I haven't looked at it. Maybe.
Okay. There was a moment. There was an actual moment in 2016 when Kelly Furtado, who was the then deputy chief of staff, had brought in all these carpet tiles. The management company at the convention center, we were always doing battle with them because it was like, yeah, you're not doing a good enough job. We're paying you all this money. And they were always trying to make nice with us in one way or another. And this, like, the manager of the facilities were like, we're going to let Mayor Swearingen pick the carpet of the convention center, the remodel of the convention center. Kelly had carpet tiles everywhere in her office. And we went through all of the, we did whatever. I got to pick the carpet. And I picked a like deep black, but it has a little bit of a silvery kind of hue to it when the light catches it just a certain way. And then the way they installed it is like the grain goes this way on this tile, and then they turned it on the next. And so it has a little bit of texture to it. And I thought it was very classy. Because I'll tell you one thing I hate is going into a convention center and feeling like I'm at the circus. Mm. I don't need to go to the circus when I'm at the convention center. So we picked something very durable, classy, blah, blah, blah. In addition to the carpet, I have to say, the surface water treatment plant in Southeast Fresno that secured Fresno's water future, that we fought like cats and dogs with county supervisors to get that enacted and to get through lawsuits and get through a Prop 218 and all of that. Like, the city of Fresno's water future is in really pretty good shape because of that investment. And it meant we had to raise everybody's water rate, so sorry about that, but not sorry, because your kids and grandkids will have surface water. You're welcome.
And now, while a lot of communities outside of Fresno are struggling to find water, we are
that
sitting pretty.
That. And, you know, hearing from city staff and experts who were like, man, we've been trying to do this for 20 years, but like people were always afraid, politicians were always afraid to be like, hey, good news, we're raising your water rates. It's just like doing the right thing for the right reason and honoring the work of those people. But Fresno sits between two rivers. We actually are very well, very well situated with water. It's like one of the only good things that we're like, this is going for us. And then we had to work really hard to get a new conveyance agreement with Fresno Irrigation District. That had been expired for 40 years at the time. So we went round and round, got that done so that surface water could be treated and delivered to people in the city of Fresno. That was a big deal. And in the process, we negotiated a little thing I like to call a blue belt that went around the Fresno metro area that Clovis would have to abide by the same constraints. Otherwise, our conveyance agreement would be opened up and we would have access to more water. And everyone got mad about it after we left. Mm. That was fun.
Sorry.
No.
So a couple of weeks ago, we did a podcast around organized labor's role in the world of politics in Fresno. I'm curious about how your thoughts on organized labor have evolved and changed since you were mayor.
Yeah, I think, when you like going into budget fights, going into negotiations with organized labor groups, it's just different perspectives. So what you have to know about working with a labor group is like this group of people who come in to negotiate or whatever, like 100% the reason for them being in that room, 100% is to make sure the contract is as good as possible for their members. And like that is just the DNA of that group. And that's why they exist. They are wonderful mm-hmm. people, maybe that outside of it, but in that moment and in that role, they only care about one thing. Like, it's their role. And we always were coming into the room with, oh my God, we all have this big budget crisis. Can you help us solve it? And there was some good, I don't want to paint a picture that we didn't have cooperation and some good back and forth. But I guess I just thought it was like, can't we all see that if we can save some money on our existing contract, we don't have to lay people off? I thought that was going to be a welcome thing. And it was sometimes, but it wasn't always. And that really didn't make sense to me for a long time. And about 5 years in, which is as long as the Great Recession went on for us at the city, at about the five-year mark, I realized, you know what, it's not going to be the perspective of certain labor groups. It's just not going to be. So stop expecting that it's going to change. So I just changed my expectation, and it made it a little bit easier to, I got outside of this conflict of, it was a power struggle, honestly, just like a great big power struggle. And I felt relieved from that. And then, yeah, I think it was a lot easier from there to navigate those relationships.
Okay. I have another fun community question. Someone asked, what is your opinion of Mayor Jerry Dyer? And I'm going to add, and can you respond to the shadow mayor allegations?
Aye. Let me start with the allegations first. First, let me say it's a really sensitive point for me for some reason. I went right from being at the city of Fresno through 2016. In 2017, Danielle Bergstrom, God bless her, she will live 6 months short on her life because she was primary staff to the Transformative Climate Communities Project, which we carried at the Community Foundation. And we did that in cooperation and support with Mayor Brand. And then 2018 came around and it was Measure P. And there were a lot of accusations that the Community Foundation was supporting Measure P because I had a need to still be in charge of things. And there were a lot of really terrible things that were said publicly about the city's park system, what a waste it is, why we should never invest in it, by people who were carrying out their vengeance on things they didn't like about me when I was mayor. And they exacted their revenge through getting on board with the No on P campaign. And it was very personal. The incoming direct from the mouths of those people was like, we just have to show her she's not in charge. And it was really burdensome to think that a bunch of people were coming together to make this big investment in the city's parks, all the data that shows the positives around that, blah, blah, blah. And that there were people, and in this case, people with money, who would just be like, yeah, but we hate that bitch, so we're going to fight this. That's what went down. And
how much of that is misogyny?
That's a really good question. Like, the farther I get away from that little circumstances, the more I think it was a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I wonder if Mayor Autry got involved in Measure P immediately, or in a parks ballot measure immediately following his term in office, if developers and unions that arm wrestled with, if they would have treat him the same way. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was a thing. I do. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that was really hard. I lost friends over that. Like, it was nasty. But what people didn't understand, I tried to make this case, but as people just couldn't hear me, I worked for an organization that at the time was 50 years old, that preceded all of the public office holders, and that preceded all of the current developers who were fighting Measure P, and who had a donor whose father-in-law in the late 1800s had generated some wealth in the area, left the money to his son and daughter-in-law who didn't have children. And when the daughter-in-law passed, in the name of her deceased father-in-law, a man named Louis Gundelfinger, who loved the city's park systems and music organizations, left money at the Community Foundation and said, every year, make sure you invest these dollars in something that's going to improve the city's park system. So now I work for a board that is the steward of those dollars, and our community has worked hard for years to put a parks master plan together that now identified clearly what the infrastructure requirements were, what the all this kind of stuff. And this thing's ready for a public ballot measure. And because I'm a former office holder, my organization can't get involved when we represent the donor's family. That's, hey, do something really good and big with this money for parks. So I went through all that, and everybody thought that was on the no side, a part of it. And certainly there were a person could say, no, I just think we should have had a cops tax and not a parks tax. I wouldn't agree, but on the merits, fine. You can have that different opinion. But the personal nature of it was so awful that kind of coming off of that, the shadow mayor allegation is painful. So I think the shadow mayor allegation is, look, I think I understand why that can be sensitive for current office holders. I really do try to stay out of the way, but I also just remind myself and my colleagues working on behalf of the community of Fresno and the greater Central Valley, I did community development work way before I was mayor. I served as mayor for 8 years. I learned a lot of stuff. I helped create a bunch of investable opportunities. I now work for an organization that is almost 60 years old, whose task and mandate is to try to attract money to this area and actually change the big challenges of this place. So I'm still doing that work. I did it before I was mayor, I did it while I was mayor, and I'm doing it now. So if that is problematic, I get it, but I'm different from Mayor Autry. Mayor Autry was a TV actor, and then he was mayor, did a great job in a lot of ways, and then I followed him. I just hope people see that. Like, I've been doing this work my entire career, so why would it be different now? And why would my organization say, oh, let's hold back because we don't want someone to be offended and think that this person's still trying to be in charge? The fact of the matter is, I don't present a budget. I don't have veto authority over, but I am a citizen of Fresno and I should be able to get involved also as a private volunteer to do things that I want to do in my community.
Don't you think it's partially a function of, I feel like our politics in Fresno are somewhat less evolved than other places I've worked in, where it's a lot more normal in other large cities and regions to have the government, but then non-governmental organizations be a lot more active in change efforts.
Yes.
And it's not,
I think that's true.
City Hall is one piece of the puzzle.
That's right. I think our civic arena, the fabric, let's say, of our civic sector, the place in the middle where we all meet from different sectors to try to figure out how to make things better, it's not as congested, it's not as dense here. There are a few large scale actors, right? City of Fresno, major public agencies, school districts, County of Fresno, and then there are a lot of small nonprofits that are pretty subscale. Punching above their weight, you could argue, but yeah, I think the ecosystem is different here. I think that's true. And then I also think the strong mayor form of government definitely puts a spotlight, at least historically it has. Back when there was like a more traditional media market where front page above the fold and 4 TV cameras every day had a story about something happening at the city of Fresno. That was true for 20 years from 96 up until more recently with the, or was it 94? I think the strong mayor was adopted anyway. So that place is pretty concentrated too with focus and the political environment.
Yeah. Well, let's circle back to the beginning of the question though. How's Dyer doing?
I think he's doing pretty well. We don't stay in touch. I'm not super close in on the things that are closest to his heart, that he's like working hard every day, swinging the hammer. God, I really want to live to see this thing happen. I'm not really sure what that fire is for him, but I don't have any critique. I know many of his staff intimately, and I know them to be super quality, expert, committed, integrous people. So yeah, I just have to trust that they're doing okay.
Fresno has a large undocumented population, and here's another community question. How will the foundation respond to protect immigrants in our region as Trump takes office?
Yeah, we have a little bit of experience from Trump 1, and we're not a direct service provider, but we have a network of donors, and we can also receive funds from larger foundations and help find good organizations that are going to provide quality services. So it's a bit of an intermediary role. I will say that in Trump 1, we were not asked to play that role much. I think there was a lot more like large foundations directly funding service providing organizations. But to the extent that we've got networks of folks that are like, I'll say this, I also think this region is much more on the radar with larger scale funders because of COVID. Mm-hmm. We definitely noticed that during the pandemic, there was a huge sort of awakening of major national philanthropy around, oh my God, what? There's a Central California? And it was a lot around, well, what it actually is going on with our food supply, and a lot of concern about whether or not we were going to be safe and as it relates to food. And then there was a lot of opportunity to tell the story of the region and the people who are working sick and frontline food and farm workers, essential workers, et cetera. So I wonder that could be good and bad, right? Like foundations and philanthropy is paying a lot more attention here, but also will the federal government pay attention here as well? I don't know. Then the other thing is you got to consider, you know, you got these big ag interests that are oftentimes very Trump aligned, that have close relationships with people who get pulled into the administration, or at least they did last time around. those folks usually lend their voices pretty loudly around, stop it, protect our region. So it's going to be an interesting, I also just pass this along. One of my board members is a small farmer in the area, and he was sharing that in the immediate aftermath of the election, his farm worker crew was like, yeah, we're not worried about it because he didn't get us the first time. We don't think he's going to get us the second time. So I've heard two different points of view. This is devastating and terrifying. And the governor told the story yesterday in the press gaggle about hearing from an undocumented young woman who was in the middle of chemotherapy, who was making the decision to not get further treatment because she just needed to go underground and didn't want to be going to a hospital where records were being kept. So life or death decision that she's making because of her fear, so extreme concern and understandable. And then also, I know a lot of documented but very connected to the undocumented community Latinos in the Fresno area who did vote for Trump.
Right.
So, you know, and people who are like, yeah, they're not going to find it. So I don't know what to expect. But what we would, our position at the Community Foundation would be like, look, we support philanthropic activities here. If we have, we try to match make service providers and donors, and we would do that no matter what, and certainly in this circumstance.
So this episode's coming out the week of Thanksgiving, and we always end our episodes with what we're loving this week. And we're going to end with sharing some of our favorite parts of the Thanksgiving meal. So we'll start with you, Ashley. What is your favorite side dish, and what's your favorite pie at Thanksgiving?
Ooh, Nellie. Favorite side dish is for sure my mother's stuffing.
Okay, what's the secret to it?
I don't know, because she's been gone 3 years and we can't figure it out.
Oh, no.
So we tried, actually, her last year with us. My dad tried to make it, and it was awful. And then, yeah, we've just not been able to recreate it. I have the recipe, but I just haven't mastered it quite yet.
Okay, and your favorite pie?
I actually have taken over pie-making responsibilities from my mom. My mom would do this. My grandmother was the queen pie maker. My mom did it pretty well, and then I got a little bit of it, and I have the recipes from my mom. So I've been making pies. My chocolate's really good. My coconut's really good. And my lemon's really good.
Oh, I love a lemon pie.
And you know
anything,
what?
Maybe some meringue on top or something.
Oh, absolutely. The meringue. Now, I can't get my meringue to, it always sweats.
Mm.
And I've gotten some real experts involved, and no one can figure this out. So obviously.
I think you need a torch. That's what I would say. Just no, torch the
it's
top.
The,
or it sweats
even
underneath.
Even if you do that, it sweats underneath.
Okay.
So I need someone to help me with that. But but my secret actually is the crust.
Mm.
The filling is pretty routine. Anybody can do the filling. Obviously, not everybody can do the meringue. I can't do the meringue. It's the crust, and I have the best touch and the best recipe on that.
Do you put vodka in your crust?
No. Is that a thing?
Yes. What do you use, butter or shortening?
My mom's recipe calls for shortening.
Okay.
So that's where that flavor comes from, I'm sure. Donnie, what about you? What's your favorite side dish and pie?
I make a cranberry curd tart from the New York Times. That is...
I just made that this week.
Isn't it so good?
It's so good. And people are always turned off by the cranberries on a tart.
No,
because it's one note in theory.
It's perfect, but I don't... They recommend a hazelnut crust, and I just do a pâté brisé, and it's perfect.
Okay, and then side dish.
Side dish. My sister Yvette makes a really amazing green bean casserole. She nailed it every
Ooh.
Year. I know.
The green beans are like fresh and
yeah
lovely.
No, she's legit. She doesn't go the canned route.
Yeah.
And she's not a cook, actually. She's not a cook in most ways except for green bean casserole.
Growing up in the South, do you know what your green bean casserole looks like? It is canned green beans with just like absolutely drenched in whatever is the
cream
white
of mushrooms.
Yes. As a kid, I'm like.
With those Heinz crusty onions on top.
That was so, if you got a good one, hang
go
on
eat
to
that.
It.
I'm on the same page with you. I think my side dish is stuffing. It's bread. It's bread. And I think the secret, one of the secrets that I've learned is adding a little bit of cheese to the stuffing. So there's a little bit of some umami and unctuousness to it.
Okay.
And then in terms of pie, I'm a pecan pie devotee.
Okay.
I actually prefer the bars. Like I prefer to make pecan pie bars so you can eat more of them.
Yeah.
And Donnie's wrong. It is the best pie on the
Pecans
table.
Pecans are disgusting. No.
Just okay, maybe you haven't had the right pecan pie.
Have you heard of a horse race pie?
No, tell me.
It's pecan, bourbon, and chocolate.
Ooh.
And it's fantastic. I bet even if you don't like a pecan
like
pie,
pecans.
Danielle, you might like a horse race pie.
I don't like nuts.
Then we'll just do one without the nuts for you.
Yeah.
It'd be just
good
a horse pie.
Just let's just give her bourbon, actually.
I will take the bourbon. I will take bourbon and chocolate.
And a little bit of pie dough.
Okay.
Ashley, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so much fun.
Thank you.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. This podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.